Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking the San Francisco's Financial District. I am Holly Wells, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Studies Section here at the Club. We also welcome our audience on the radio. Commonwealth Club programs can be heard locally on KQED FM each Friday at 8 p.m. We also invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Before I commence the introductions, I'd like to extend a special thank you to Olga Mandruso of the Environment Section, who has worked very hard to make this event happen. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's program on the topic, Environment and the Media. We are fortunate to have with us several highly experienced and prestigious members of the media to discuss their perspectives on how media outlets affect current opinions about environmental issues. First, I would like to introduce John Fowler, who is the health and science editor of Fox TV, KTVU. During his tenure at the newsroom since 1975, he has won several Emmys, as well as an international gold medal from the New York International Film and Television Festival for his reporting on health and science issues. Our second panelist is Jane Kay from the San Francisco Examiner. She is an environmental writer who has covered a wide scope of environmental stories and has received numerous national, state, and regional awards for her work. Jane has taught environmental reporting at the University of California at Berkeley and now directs the Center for Environmental Journalism at the Berkeley's Journalism Graduate School. Our third panelist is Betsy Rosenberg, host of Trash Talk for KCBS Radio. Betsy is an award-winning journalist who has worked for the three major television networks over the course of her two-decade career in broadcast news. Since joining KCBS Radio, where she created and launched Trash Talk, she has received three awards for excellence in environmental education. And now I have the great pleasure of introducing our panel moderator, Michael Krasny, who is the host of the very popular and award-winning KQED program called Forum. In addition to his radio career, he is also an author and a professor of literature. Thank you all for joining us here today. And now I turn the program over to you, Michael.
Thank you, Holly, and good evening. I think we're fortunate indeed not only that we have such fine panelists, but also panelists representing the print media, television, and radio. There's been some confusion over the years about Betsy Rosenberg, as evidenced by the fact that recently one of my colleagues at KQED, when he heard that someone had called me from Trash Talk, thought that I was dealing with one of the tabloids. What I thought we'd do this evening is begin by having each of the panelists tell us, and we'll begin, John Fowler, with you, about what you do manage to get on the air, or in print in the case of Jane Kay, with respect to environmental issues, and the kinds of stories that you feel perhaps you haven't been able to cover with the kind of thoroughness or the kind of exactitude that we'd like to see or that you personally would like to see. John?
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being here. I appreciate this opportunity to talk with you. With respect to Michael's question, the overwhelming problem facing television news is time and the lack of it. That said, we have news meetings that are held regularly in the evenings, as well as biweekly news meetings in which I and several of my other colleagues participate, in which we talk about stories we want to do. About a year and a half ago, I wanted to do a story about a then practically unknown chemical called methyl tertiary butyl ether, and everyone looked at me and said, "What?" And it turned out to be MTBE, of course, which is a story that sort of exploded on us as the problems had become increasingly too large to ignore. And we did some work and got some stories on the air and were instrumental in helping change and educate, really, the legislature. That's one of the good stories. Every week there is a bad story in which I have an idea that I'd like to propose about either an environmental story or a story that doesn't quite hit the headlines, that my editors say, well, not enough people are interested in that. And by the way, you have to do this car crash. So the key issue for my medium is that we don't have enough people to cover all the news. we can only cover the highlights, basically, of the news, and it's gratifying to me when I can get an environmental story on the air. For instance, a couple of stories about groundwater contamination that led to the MTBE story were then translated to contacts where I was able to do a story out in Livermore about an idea of infusing treated wastewater into the groundwater, and some of you may know about that story as well. And so occasionally we can build on these things, but in television it's much, much more difficult to get effective environmental stories on the air because, quite frankly, it's a small portion of the daily newscast that I can aim at. And my editors basically tell me that, you know, we have so many other stories to do. And if you read the New York Times, you'll find the environmental stories occasionally make page one, but rarely. And we basically do page one stories in TV news. So if it doesn't make page one, it really doesn't get on television news. And so that said, I think Jane should take it from here because now she's able to bring a great deal more effort and interest to the viewers because, or the readers in her case, because she can do it every day and I can only do it once every 2 or 3 weeks.
Thank you, John. Well, for me, too, I would say it's kind of a juggling act. It's okay. I can go to the Benicia Arsenal. I can go on the Russian River. I can go up to the Redwoods, and that's fine. And we're pretty sure we'll get a good story out of it. But while I'm doing those longer stories, there are all those other short, important stories that aren't getting done. There's one of me, and there are, of course, other people at the paper who help, but, you know, it takes a village. It takes many, many, many people to do these stories in the proper way. I mean, last night I just happened to be sitting at my desk and got a call about the purchase by the California Coastal Conservancy about the 1,600 acres at Belmarin Keys. Well, you know what an important story that is and how long so many people have been trying to bring that land back to tidal marsh. Well, if I wouldn't have been there, nobody would have gotten my voicemail, and we wouldn't have had the story. We would have had a skimpy little wire piece. So it's, you know, the best part, if there were, you know, a greater number of people dedicated to this beat.
Betsy.
My name is Betsy, and I'm a recovering radio news reporter, learning late in life that I'm a closet journalist. And if I could just take a couple of the minutes I have to tell you how that happened. People tend to think it's interesting that I went from being a fairly well-paid news anchor and reporter, not only for KCBS Radio, but also for CBS News in New York, to taking a bit of a vow of poverty and doing this labor of love trash talk. I recycled my career. I got diverted and went from traffic and weather together to trash and waste prevention forever about 3 years ago. I launched Trash Talk Earth Day 1997, and I knew the garbage gods were with me when, on that very same day, San Francisco garbage collectors went on strike for the first time in 57 years. So instead of taking the first week of features, one-minute features, to tell people why our waste matters, there it was piling up on the streets of San Francisco, and I was probably the only one who was disappointed when the strike was settled 2 or 3 days later. But it was very interesting because my feature airs at 11:26 in the morning and 7:22 in the evening, recycled on the weekends. But it was probably the only time that coming on at 11:26, I actually sounded redundant. There were actually 2 or 3 stories on garbage before me. And so that didn't last too long, obviously. Now I'm the only one who talks about waste on a regular basis. Why? Well, in addition to growing tired of murder, mayhem, fires, and floods after some 15 years of reporting and a few gray hairs and awards later, I am someone who's just appalled by the amount of waste in our society that we are confronted with every day, whether it's the junk mail that comes to our home, junk or not, just too much mail, or just what people throw away when you take a flight, for instance. You ever noticed how environmentally unfriendly the skies are? You know, you have one drink of juice and they give you a before, during, and after plastic cup, and you ask for more coffee and they go get you a new styrofoam cup. It's not bad enough you're using one. And when you start multiplying all that and you know how much doesn't biodegrade in the landfill, well, that just was something I always noticed for some reason. I think I was born with a gene. It just was sort of latent, and now it's manifest. And what triggered it was actually my husband of 5 years, who had some obliviously wasteful habits. And after a year of nudging him, educating him, he calls it nudging and brainwashing, but I did some operant conditioning. I was a psychology major at Berkeley before I transferred to journalism. And, he'd be brushing his teeth and shaving, and the water's running down the drain, and I would count 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 20 seconds, and he hasn't touched the water. And then I'd go, and after a year of this and catching him trying to throw away wire hangers, when I always thought everybody took back those accumulated hangers to the dry cleaners, I screeched and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Throw them away. What else do you do with them?" So I got married rather late in life, and I guess had never really lived with anyone. I thought everybody sort of did the same things I did. So that was a rude awakening for me. And he, after a year of getting this Martha Stewart of garbage treatment, decided I should take my show on the road and spread the guilt. And so I went to KCBS management and said, "You know, we have traffic and weather together and sports twice an hour and business twice an hour. We don't have anything on a regular basis on the environment." And when I would try to pitch environmental stories, I'd get something like, "Well, we did something on the environment last month." And in all fairness, that was for the in-depth, the 30-minute pieces that we do. I have all kinds of great people that I come in contact with that would make such compelling radio. But like, we did one of those. And I realized the only way to get regular environmental programming on was to create a feature. So luckily, and to KCBS's credit, they recognized that there was a void in programming. They've let me do it. Unfortunately, the budget wasn't quite there for features, so it's been a labor of love, and I've loved every minute of it.
Let me just add that I'm in the anomalous position of being in public radio, and because I work in public radio, there is a sort of sanction as well as a freedom that goes with putting on programming. Since I'm the editor and since I'm pretty unregenerate environmentalist, we do a lot of environmental programming, as those of you who listen to Forum probably know, and we do the kinds of things that probably can't be done on a regular basis in either commercial television, certainly, or commercial radio, or perhaps even print, which prompts me to ask the next question to all of you. And a number of years ago, when I was in commercial broadcasting, Russ Coughlin, who's a legend here in San Francisco, used to be the head of KGO Television and was a very popular and much loved man, said to me, "You know, the problem with these environmentalists is they just don't get it." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, we do these ascertainment programs, and every year it comes out that all these people say, yeah, we love stories about the environment. But then when we put the stories on the air, the people go to sleep. They're just not interested in those stories, even though they think it's a good sign of a social conscience that they give lip service or indications that they are interested." I wonder if any of you have found that kind of paradox in terms of deciding on stories. That is, maybe people give a sense of the importance of the environment but don't necessarily want to hear the kind of environmental coverage, especially, I would add, perhaps in where things bleed, or what bleeds leads. And I tie this into a kind of ancillary question which has to do with some articles that the Commonwealth Club sent to me that had to do with pollution and the fact that some studies have been done, and lo and behold, pollution, which some think is the major environmental problem of them all, is not covered and can't be covered because it's not a sexy enough story. So the import of my question has to do with really what's sexy, what's popular, and what therefore doesn't necessarily play to large audiences and therefore presents, again, constraints to you as journalists.
The first thing I'd like to say is in television we have to have pictures of things to talk about them. Very rarely do we have pictures of the disappeared spotted owl. They're hard to see. And even more rarely do we see the disappearing peregrine falcon. So when we talk about things that affect the environment, we almost always talk about change, and change we can't quite picture. One of the things that I've tried to do in my environmental stories has been to show a before and after, if you will, try to compare sites from before and after the Kesterson Reservoir, for instance, when it was a terrible place of pollution several years ago, almost 2 decades ago now, to what it is today. We did a story a few years ago now about that, and we showed that the birds were no longer affected by selenium. Well, selenium is not something you can see, and the birds look like they do anywhere else, and so the pictures are not compelling. And that's, I think, the primary problem for getting environmental stories on television. The pictures simply aren't compelling as they would be with a train crash, as you so eloquently put it.
Jane, some problems in terms of newsprint stories on the environment perhaps not being sexy enough or not having the kind of cachet that would bring in a lot of readers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one thing that saves us are our readers and the response that we get from our readers. So our editors can't say, well, this is boring, because when we write these stories, we get a lot of calls. And I always think at the Examiner we have like 100 readers, and they're all loyal, so they all call. But anyway, they do call, and so we do get a good response. As far as selling the story to the editors, it's true, they like things that are new. They like environmental problems they've never heard of, or they like a twist on an environmental problem, like global warming causes the hole in the ozone, something, of course, is not true, but they would like that. But
something original.
Something original. But also, you have to pitch it in a really good way and write it in a good way. And it's very, I think it's very challenging because we are.
Forgive me, what do you mean by a good way?
Well, you have to use images, and you have to use words that are fresh and new. You can't write jargon. You can't talk in government ease. You can't talk in environmentalist rhetoric. It has to be fresh and readable and something that anyone could pick up. It could be any kind of a story, and people would like to read it.
What about the whole question of advocacy? I mean, if you want to be green, for example, and you want to bring that into your reporting, do you run into problems with your editors?
Well, I always look at it this way. I mean, education writers take it for granted that there should be good schools, right? And crime reporters take it for granted that, you know, people shouldn't be getting mugged and raped on the streets. Well, in the same way, I think environmental reporters take it for granted that there are certain goals, you know, clean water, air that's sound to breathe. But then the story becomes, how do you reach the goal? And so advocacy doesn't really have a place, because you're sorting through all the facts that you have. You're trying to find the most intelligent scientists, the most credible sources, and out of all that, you're putting together your story. So it's more, you know, it's a search mission rather than advocating one position. I mean, it's true, we're starting with these certain truths, but the story is really, how do we reach those truths?
And I'd like to add one more thing, that all stories, all the stories we all do, all of us, are about people. And people drive all news stories. The stories that you find most interesting are the stories that are about some person grappling with some issue. And
you mean they tell stories?
Not only they tell stories, but the stories...
No, I mean the stories are narratives, and they involve people.
In some way, yes. But the stories that we do, that we find are done best, are stories that are about a person or a group of people dealing with an issue. And so to go do a story about the declining salmon in the Pacific Northwest, you want to go do a story about people who can't catch salmon.
How do you make trash inspiring, interesting, sexy?
That's a very good question. I met someone the other day who said, I really like your feature, but I cannot believe you're almost going on 3 years, 400 features, original features later, and you haven't run out of ideas. I keep saying that woman's going to be off the air any week, she'll run out of ideas. And if I tell you that I have more stories that I have not gotten to than I have gotten to, I swear to God I'm not exaggerating. It's an interesting thing. There's a bias against, quote, the environment, and it comes last in everything from, you know, news coverage to during the president's State of the Union address. I kept waiting for him to talk about the environment, and it came about, the speech was an hour and a half. It was well into the speech, three quarters plus, they mentioned something about the environment. And I maintain, and I'm sure everyone up here would say, you know, what is more important than the air we breathe, the water we drink, making sure we have enough energy sources for the next generations? And I think it's because, for whatever reason, it's been almost anti-establishment. It's been politicized, polarized, propagandized, and that's got to stop. And I think that's what's exciting about what I'm calling sort of the new environmentalism. So I think the way I make trash interesting and the way you make the environment interesting to a general audience, and that's who I'm speaking to, is consumers, mainstream, not the proverbial choir. The choir members are my heroes. They're the activists among us. They're out there making change and protesting at WTO and all that. But it's every day. It's soccer moms to CEOs that can do something in their own little backyard, and that's where it's really got to happen. So you make it interesting, I think, by connecting the dots, by showing, don't use the word environment, use quality of life issues. People may say they're not an environmentalist, but they certainly are concerned about urban sprawl and their 2.5-hour commute, and they may or may not realize that there's a connection between the cars we're all driving and the increase in asthma, maybe their own child's asthma. So that's where I think you make it interesting, and I think that's beginning to happen. And I think the time is right for a new environmentalism movement because, hey, guess what? It's not the economy anymore. It's the environment, stupid. I mean, the economy is strong, and when the economy is strong, we are consuming more, disposing more than ever. You know, crime is down, unemployment is down. If we don't, as part of this millennium momentum, start factoring in the environment in every aspect of life, we are in trouble.
But let's talk a bit about, I want to go to the questions next because we have some really important and very good questions, which I thank all of you for. But let's talk a bit about how you decide. I mean, self-interest has been brought up as an important reason, selecting environmental or quality of life stories, originality, that is, you know, you beat the pack in terms of journalism and you're there first, or human interest stories and so forth. But is there any principle of triage behind how you go about selecting stories? In other words, is one environmental issue going to be more important? Is the ozone going to be more important than the greenhouse effect, more important than, let's say, the population problem and so forth? And should one be making those kinds of decisions in the media?
Jane? Whoa.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Michael. You know, every day you have, you know, you're sifting through all the faxes and mail and emails that are coming in to you, and most people want you to write a story. I mean, it's everything from companies that want you to, you know, push a product to, you know, an environmental group that's very concerned about an issue, and you're trying to decide, you know, what it is. And you know, what is it? I don't know what it is. I mean, there's something, I mean, okay, you get something from the Audubon Society, and they're telling you that this week there's going to be a backyard bird count, and you just know you have to do that story because it's interesting. You know that we need to know how many birds are out there. We need, and I know that the readers really care about this. I mean, I get calls from people all the time who are telling me about the status of their birds. The story allows us to do deeper research into the status of the birds in the Bay Area. So that's, you know, that's a story that one wants to do. You get another from a call from El Dorado County where people up there are finding that they're building houses in serpentine, and that serpentine is releasing, is asbestos, and is releasing it into the air. You know, you make time to do that story, and you go up there. But, you know, Michael, I can't answer your question. I don't know really how we pick them. I mean, in part we pick them because they're new. We pick them for interest. We pick them because we think they're important.
Sometimes, if you'll forgive the metaphor with, which may make us think of uranium, it's a Geiger counter, kind of.
I mean,
your own inner Geiger counter.
It's the antenna. I mean, that's what makes you a reporter, I think.
Speaking of what makes you a reporter, here's a question that came from the audience that I'd like to follow up with you, Jane. Why do you think the Portland, Oregon paper has 7 or 8 reporters assigned to the environment and the San Francisco Examiner has only one?
Because They have a very good management. They have a very good ownership up there, and they know on the Puget Sound that people are living off the water, and they know the importance of their salmon, and they can look around them and see what has happened to their trees, and it's their environment is, they see it every day, they eat it, and they are lucky enough to have Len Reed, an editor of that pack of reporters, who takes that team all around. When they had that oil spill just south of them, they were down there immediately, and they were down there for 2 weeks covering that story, and I admire that very much, and I don't, it's up to the owners and the management.
Let me just follow that up with one more that's apropos. Currently, the New York Times and the Washington Post have no environmental correspondents in Washington, D.C. Is the issue dead, or are readers really seeking infotainment?
You know, that really surprises me. Is that really true?
Yeah. Just so happens I got this blurb. If I can just take a second and read it, I'm one of my hundreds of listservs I get every day. Some say the environment has been getting short shrift at two of the top U.S. newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of which have gone months without full-time reporters on the environmental beat. Word has it that the Times has finally tapped someone to fill its vacancy, Douglas Gell, fresh from the paper's Cairo bureau. Quote, I don't know why it's taken this long, said Bud Ward of the Environmental Health Center, who writes regularly about the environmental journalism world. The Times' environmental coverage drives things, he said. Still no word on the vacancy at the Post. So,
John Fowler.
People will gravitate to what they want to know about. And I think one of the pitfalls, as well as one of the wonderful things about the Internet, is that people get to select the news they want. That's wonderful in some sense because you can get a greater depth of information about it. It's also somewhat worrisome to me because most people may not want to seek out news that they, quote, need. And it's our job as professionals to try to tell people things that they need to know. That's what I try to do every day. That's what all of us try to do every day, try to tell people what they need to know. I'm a frustrated teacher, I guess, because what I'm trying to do is educate the public about a whole variety of issues. For me, I think that if the New York Times? My goodness gracious. Has no environmental report, it's because for some reason management has decided people don't want that. I think that's a terrible mistake. A newspaper with that sort of resources and that kind of credibility needs to have, in my opinion, someone strong, and or many people strong in that particular.
Follow-up question for you, John. What about coverage of environmental stories from the perspective of the so-called bad guys? For example, when you cover Tosco, do you stop and consider the company's point of view, even if it's weak?
I have to say we do, because one of the things that we're taught when we do this business is that we have to be fair. And more than just learning that, that is, to me, an integral part of what I do. I try to be fair. I try to put myself in the position of the other person on each side of a story, on all sides of a story. Sometimes there are five or six sides. One of the things that gets lost often in the shorthand of television news is the depth of someone's position. And that you will see, and I get fire from it all the time. I only have 2.5 minutes, which is actually a long time in television news, but I only have about 2.5 minutes to tell a story. And I can't give all of the rationales, all of the possible scenarios that could happen for, say, Tosco and when they had their disaster. I can't explain all of it because I first don't know all of it, but secondly, I can't give enough time to each of the details to make it understandable. And so I have to give it, unfortunately, somewhat short shrift. I also give short shrift to the other side as well, so everyone can complain. But I think one of the things that we have to watch is not going for the, quote, bad guy. It's a great story if there's a bad guy and a good guy, but almost never in any human relation is there a bad guy and a good guy exclusively. There's a little gray in everyone. So.
Well, some people think politicians are bad guys, and here's a, or some of them at least, here's a question which I'm afraid when I read it, I can't help getting a kind of knee-jerk response to. Political candidates regularly rush to label themselves the environmental president or senator. Does the media do a good enough job of justifying or deflating these claims? And my immediate response is no, they don't.
I agree. And again, partly because we don't have enough time in my...
Or for that matter, to hold politicians accountable for what they say as opposed to what they do. I think you know, media...
Interesting, the Wall Street Journal today, this is Monday is it Monday?
Good.
It's Tuesday the 15th. Oh, my goodness.
Tuesday, it must be a common month.
The Wall Street Journal today has an opinion about... the opinion piece about Bill Bradley and Al Gore and having them not having their feet held to the fire over environmental radicals and the damage that some of the splinter groups have done, for instance, around the country. And still they haven't disavowed the, I think it's Earth Liberation Front, I believe, the people who have claimed responsibility for the some fires and some damage over the past...
The monkey wrenching, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, here's a question for all of you. Betsy, I guess we'll begin with you. As a journalist, to whom do you turn for accurate information on a controversial environmental issue? Scientists or engineers, environmental activists, politicians, Hollywood celebrities?
All of the above. I think that's where being a broadcast journalist for 17 years before I launched Trash Talk comes in handy. It's instinctive. You know, you get to a certain point where you just know who to go to or where to go to get the information. I never claimed to be an environmental expert. I've just been doing this, you know, 2.5 years. But I know how to reach, quote, experts. And I have sort of a different animal because my feature is only 60 seconds. They're blurbs. You do those blurbs. Yeah, that's my life, you know, commitment to do those blurbs. And in 60 seconds, how much can you do? So my focus is sort of news you can use, what I call the how-tos of environmental protection. Running the risk, yes, of oversimplifying and, you know, making things, you know, just appear to be easier than they perhaps are. But the beauty of that is you can, you know, reach a wide audience and be sandwiched between business and traffic. So I digress, I know. Getting back to how do I know who to call, you do accumulate, you know, a good database of resources. It's amazing to me how many people, you know, first of all, a lot of experts, quote, experts either live in the Bay Area or come through here or would come through here for an interview if you just picked up the phone and asked. So, and I do travel to conferences, and that's how I've brought myself up to speed. That's how I learn, is listening to the experts. I'm not an expert. I'm a journalist who cares about the subject matter and thinks it should get more coverage. I just want to say one thing. I heard a good line at the Society of Environmental Journalists conference I attended last fall. And by the way, that was the first conference I attended where there was anyone that I considered a mainstream news reporter. I often see Recycling Times, you know, with a reporter, Waste Age magazine with a reporter, but Steve Curwood was there from Living on Earth, and it was such a pleasure to see another environmental radio reporter. Anyway, they talked about environmental stories don't break, they leak, and that is part of the problem, is they sort of ooze, you know, and they're more, they in a sense, I think Jane has a much harder job, you know, writing a longer newspaper piece. It does require a lot more fact-checking and fleshing out of the story. In a way, I have it sort of easy because I can do these little bits. But they have to be accurate, and I have to be credible. But I think that's why people listen to me, because they don't see me as, you know, I hate the term tree hugger, but I hope I've acquired a little bit of credibility in all those years of reporting. And to hear these stories come from someone who hopefully they have some sense of respect for, or just the assumption that if you work for CBS, you can't be too biased. They take that with a little bit more value. And most of the stories I cover are not so controversial, but when I do something on plastics, which is probably the most controversial aspect of waste in the waste prevention world, I know that I've got to talk to the American Plastics Council just instinctively, or I'm going to justifiably get letters from saying you were talking about how the plastics industry really needs to use recycled content in more of their bottles. There's a big protest against Coke right now, somewhat controversial, so I tried to get a response from Coke. Of course, they didn't respond until the next day, which in Radio Land is, you know, a year later. So you just sort of know.
Jane, you want to talk about your sources? I mean, without giving any of them away, of course, or who you go to. In fact, it prompts me to ask, do you ever hear from whistleblowers?
Yes, I do. I do hear from whistleblowers, and I learned a long time ago that just because someone has an axe to grind doesn't mean that they don't have some kind of tip to check out, and you have to check it out, and I've gotten some of my best stories that way. But I think of all the lists that was – that the questioner gave. I think that science is quite important in environmental story because, think about it, it wasn't until we really found the MTBE in the 10,000 test wells, and it wasn't until we saw the body of the scientists moving over the years toward believing that we were beginning to see the effects of global warming, you know, as in the boring into the ice caps and by the other indicators. It wasn't until we began to be able to see, you know about the holes in the ozone. And it wasn't until we understood what marshes really do that the story became profound. And then we cared about what people had to say. We then went to either business or another entity that might be ourselves in terms of global warming and cars that might be contributing to the problem. So we're always looking for the latest solid study to try to help us learn about the workings of the planet and then how we can solve the problem, who's to blame, you know, should there be other laws to prevent some activities from taking place. But it really revolves around the science. Sometimes we don't have the science. In the case of cancer-causing chemicals and products, we are only in the infancy, but we, of course, are looking at animal studies, which are giving pretty good indications. And in that case, reporters just have to tell what we can tell and just, you know, say what is known by the credible scientists, and then let the readers, you know, try to make judgments on it. I mean, I don't think that we should shy away from the story if we don't have the final science, because really we never do have that.
Those are such difficult areas. I mean, when you think about something like a civil action, for example, it seems to symbolize in many ways the problem with, say, epidemiology and actually locating for sure, you know, the smoking gun, the incontrovertible proof of some kind of environmental disaster being linked, let's say, to metastasizing cells. So is it your inclination as a reporter, therefore, to get both sides, to make sure that both sides are represented in the article?
Oh, you have to get all the sides. For one thing, it is such a poor story that it holds no weight if you don't get all the sides, and you're in for the surprise of your life because you go out and you think you've got the story and you know what it's going to be, and you start going to all the players and you find out that it's not what you thought at all, that, you know, that there are reasons for this happening. And I mean, think of it, I always think of how lawyers describe the outcome of a lawsuit. I mean, it was so, you know, last week or the week before, the U.S. District Court decided on that long issue about whether the Bureau of Reclamation had to provide drainage for the farmers in the Central Valley. And as you know, it was the San Luis Drain that ended up in the Kesterson National Wildlife Refuge and the selenium, and it deformed all the birds, and we knew that selenium was a bad thing, okay? Okay, so the environmental group calls me and says, this is a great decision because the Bureau doesn't have to build a drain, and that drain is not going to end up in the bay. Okay, then I get a fax from Westlands Water District, and they say, this was a great decision because the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has to provide some kind of disposal for us in the valley. So, I mean, you know, you have to check it out. You have to check it out.
You can't even get scientists to agree on the ozone and the nature of greenhouse gas, for that matter.
If scientists have all the answers, they lack the hammer they need to get more funding. One of the things I've learned over 25 years of reporting is that everyone has some sort of bias, that whether it's a bias in appreciating the environment or a bias in trying to get more funding for a particular scientific project. Everyone has a bias. That doesn't mean the science is wrong or the person is bad. Everyone has a bias. And I think that's what we have to do as journalists, is to recognize the source's bias, factor that into the information we're getting.
Or recognize where the money is coming from. I mean, if a scientist is doing research, for example, and he takes a position against something that perhaps may seem like a good environmental issue, then it's important for the public to know where the source of money is coming from.
That's one of the failures, I think, in our business, that we haven't adequately described and elucidated where the money is coming from for a lot of these.
I agree with you. I think it's a big failure. Here's another question from someone in our audience. There was a book written entitled Why There Are No Poor People in the Sierra Club. Isn't environmentalism kind of a provocative question, but isn't environmentalism, this questioner wants to know, a limousine liberal issue? Anybody respond?
Well, I could take that. You know, I really don't think so. You know, you look at West County Toxics Coalition in Richmond, really strong, really grassroots people, bringing some of the major changes, you know, on how the refineries are regulated. You look at Lois Gibbs, you know, the Love Canal and her national group. You look at Penny Newman down in Southern California. And, you know, I've really found, as I go around over the decades, on especially the toxic waste sites that are in people's neighborhoods, I mean, you have people who started out not even thinking about the environment, and then something happens in their lives, you know. Somebody gets sick, they see orange clouds coming out of their neighbor, they read in the newspaper that their water, it has chromium in it, and this is what really turns a lot of people into environmentalists, and they are very well schooled, many of them are very objective. They can tell you their positions, but they can also tell you the industry's position, the government's position. I never agree with that.
Question for Betsy Rosenberg. Your show is amazing. They should air it once an hour. Betsy would not disagree, I'm sure. How can we help spread the word about recycling in grocery stores and city government and other places? And another person wants to know, are other countries recycling? Perhaps you could address that as well.
Let me start with the second question. That's a little bit easier. It's interesting. There are several sort of hotbeds of environmental activism in Europe, Scandinavia being one. For instance, I don't know how many of you have heard of the Natural Step, but they basically are an organization that trains companies how to embrace sustainable practices. And McDonald's of Sweden is a member, but U.S. McDonald's is not. They recycle everything in Sweden. Why? And why do they do it so much in the Netherlands and Germany and Canada? Well, at least in the first three instances, you know, the nations are smaller. They have less space for landfill. They are also, I just think, ahead of us in a lot of ways. On the other hand, I was in Italy last year, and on the beautiful Amalfi Coast, there was trash along the beaches, and some American there, when they heard what I did, said, oh, they need trash talk here, and started telling me what they had seen in the way of what's dumped. So it's a mix, but what you may not know, this was probably the most interesting trash talk feature I ever did. I interviewed someone who's sort of an eco-designer, and he was a consultant in Silicon Valley for 15 years, and he told me that companies in our own backyard, Hewlett-Packard, Sony, are manufacturing and exporting to European nations computers and other appliances that are designed for disassembly, recycle-friendly, meaning instead of being made with glue that you can't unstick with a sledgehammer, made with Velcro, so that it's producer responsibility, manufacturer responsibility, which is just beginning to, you know, take hold in this country. So in other words, you know, American companies are successfully selling computers to Germans, let's say, and then those Germans send the computers back to Hewlett-Packard, and so that the buyer doesn't want to own the computer, buyer doesn't want to own the carpet, send it back and let the carpet nylon be recycled. And that's the whole industrial ecology movement. It's beginning to take hold, and it's very interesting. And we're a country unique unto ourselves.
Jen Feller, I think this question goes to you. I've never considered calling or writing to the media to comment or suggest a story. Do all these get processed? Is this the best way for the public to encourage more coverage? And I ask you because Jane was saying that she gets a lot of ideas from people who read The Examiner, and Betsy has said she certainly gets ideas from her listeners, but in TV it's so hard because you're doing the front page stuff. Do you take ideas from listeners, and do you often turn them into stories, or can you?
We do. I get a great deal of email. I've let my email address go out, and I get a lot. So I see these stories, and often I do them. And I'll tell you what I get mostly are stories about medicine and science rather than about environment. And I'm not sure whether that's a result of people's expectation that perhaps they can learn something for their own bodies, or perhaps they're more interested in medical stories. But I've gotten a couple of good story ideas for environmental stories from my email and telephone calls. One of them was a story we did about the coyotes overpopulating the interurban land areas where the wildlands and the and rural areas are interfacing with expanding population. Shortly after I did that story, I received another flood of email from people who were outraged that I did a story about hurting those poor little coyotes, because the story we did was about this man who was actually trapping them.
I was one of those.
You were one of those. Yeah. and I had to defend the practice as best I could by referring them to the man who did the trapping. But we do get a lot of our information from, at least story idea information, from viewers. However, and I have to go back to what I said before, we just basically can do front page stories. And so if it's a story idea that works into a, quote, front page story, then it comes from you. But most often it's not, unfortunately. And I have to say that we often, and most often, follow newspapers and their ability to dig out stories. And for television, we're at least historically, we've been the people who read the newspaper the most closely and get the very best stories out of them and turn around and put them on the air the next night. So the long and short of it is, yes, we do take information from viewers, but only maybe one-tenth of the ideas are passed on actually into stories that make the air.
There's a questioner who asks, and I think we've to some extent really broached this question, what makes an issue mediagenic, but then goes on to say, how, if at all, has the advent of the Internet changed the equation of what's mediagenic in terms of environmental coverage? Maybe we ought to just talk about for the moment or consider how the Internet has really affected environmental coverage. Betsy?
I'll say something about that, but I just forgot the punchline on the story about producer responsibility. These companies are exporting, but it doesn't happen here. They don't sell us those products, those very same products. How come? There's no mandate from the public, from the government. There's no leadership there. And I think if the average American was aware of this, they would say, I don't need to keep my computer and then worry about what to do with it when it's done. I'd like to send it back to you, Hewlett-Packard, and let you do something productive with it. So just one of the many ways that, we can help raise consciousness. And as far as the Internet...
Before you go to the Internet, I'm going to break in here with another question.
Okay.
Because it, again, comes from a member of the audience, and it's dovetails. This question is phrased as such. Do you think that Americans are making the connection between environmental issues and campaign finance reform, which I find to be a fascinating question in the sense that, of course, campaign finance reform has a great deal to do with the degradation of the environment or the need for campaign finance reform. I mean, I think anybody who studies the way politics are made in this country would come to that realization. And yet that's something that's very difficult to sort of weasel into or shoehorn in or sneak into your or into any of your coverage, I would imagine.
Well,
I mean, I can blab about it in public radio, but, it's tougher, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, for me, the environmental stories I do are almost exclusively science stories and stories about people trying to deal with the science of
which really, in a sense, omits this kind of...
Yes, exactly. And so the politics of it seem to cross into an area that I think my editors have felt, although I haven't actually pushed that particular point, but I'm certain that my editors would say that's not really a science story, that's a political story for the political reporter. And
your editors might be concerned about ticking off the advertisers, too, who are some of
perhaps
those people. Yeah, Betsy?
I was just going to say that's the beauty of what I do. I don't think anyone at KCBS in management is listening. So I get to be the writer, editor, and I know listeners are listening because I get great letters, and that's what keeps me going, and the occasional award. But what excites me about what I get to do is I just recently talked to someone who thinks campaign finance reform is critical to making an eco U-turn. And turning things around. And I can do a 20-minute interview with her, as I did, and as soon as I find time to start another series, I'm in the middle of a 6-week series on paper now, you know, put her on the air saying, this is key, and I can do that, and that's the fun part. And speaking of listeners giving ideas, in this series I did something on whatever happened to the paperless office. The paperless office is, in fact, Pulp Fiction, and someone called me up and said, no, it's not. I've got a paperless office, and we did it through imaging technology. I said, wait. I turned on my tape recorder, interviewed her over the phone, and put out her website, and she actually goes out and shows people how they can save rent, money, staff, which may not be a good thing, by going paperless through image. You know, I didn't even know about imaging technology, so I do get some great sources there. And when you're ready to go to the Internet, I have some exciting
news. Yeah, I am, but
news.
Jane had something she wanted to put in here.
I just wanted to talk about campaign reform. Usually you don't see a lot of environmental analysis on the candidates, you know, before the primary, which is too bad. But one of the very few solid stories that has been done, I don't know if you saw it was by the LA Times. And the LA Times contracted with, I think, a company who actually did the analysis and looked at campaign contributions to Governor Bush and how that linked in to some of the positions that he had been taking as governor. So I think who gives money to whom is always part of a good environmental story.
Onto the Internet. How has it really played, or how does it continue to change the nature of coverage of the environment? I mean, obviously we're assailed with much more information than we ever dreamed mm-hmm. of, but on a day-to-day basis mm-hmm. of covering and reporting and journalistic endeavors with the environment, what's happened?
Well, I find myself included in internal club or government workings. People will just kind of whip off a letter to you that they've sent to someone, and so you can keep abreast of the issue, you know, at a pretty early stage. Of course, the research, it makes research so amazing. I mean, huge reports that don't have to be faxed or messaged. I mean, you just have them, and you can get them off of government sites, and you can... It's just amazing, and it helps, you know, just linking from one site to others. I mean, when I was researching about...
We're not including hacking activity here.
Of course not, Michael. But, you know, trying to research genetically altered crops and the effects on food. I mean, there were sites, there was research done that I would never have known about without that help.
I agree. It's
been a wonderful, anyways, isn't it?
It's been a huge boon, I think, to all reporters, but mm-hmm. particularly those in the sciences, though, mm-hmm. because the Internet, of course, was designed to link scientists, and it has proven to be, I think, probably the greatest resource in my life. I spend too many hours on it, my wife will tell you. But I appreciate the information I can get because I have such quick access to so many diverse opinions. And I think that is really the key to being a good reporter, is getting all the ideas.
Here's a question that strikes me as certainly important about the future and what we've been talking about in subtextual ways here. What about environmental education? Do any of you work with kids to make them more eco-conscious? Or perhaps I might amend to that question. Are you aware of kids in your reporting and education? I mean, John, you said you're a frustrated teacher, and a lot of the work that you do borders on being an educator.
My kids teach me a lot about environmental issues because I see things newly through their eyes. And so when I do stories, particularly stories about the environment, I think of them and have discussed it with them, say, the night before, but I do the story. And so in many ways, there's a little child inside of me still trying to tell that story, and it's my daughter.
Mm-hmm. Betsy?
I love going out to talk to school kids. I usually do it a lot around Earth Day. But my target audience is what I call my fellow boomers, because the kids, fortunately, are getting a little bit of the education in school. The older generations have that, you know, depression, World War II, frugality, conservation mentality by nature. And so I'm trying to reach, as I say, the 30, 40, 50-something crowd, we have several wasteful decades ahead, and that's why I try to stay on commercial radio. And can I just say something about the Internet? Because I didn't get a chance. There's a lot of grassroots activism taking place there. It's a great organizing tool. There's a lot of information being exchanged. And the three rainbows on the horizon. One, I was at the National Town Meeting for Sustainable America, Al Gore's powwow last May in Detroit, and there were some 3,000 Americans there, not the usual suspects, by the way, talking about issues like traffic, sprawl, smog, but there were some 30,000 people who supposedly took part via the web, who listened in and communicated. There was some interaction there. Secondly, Working Assets is getting into the broadcasting business. They have started, if you click onto workingassets.com, you can hear simulcast their station that they just bought in Boulder, Colorado, and they're going to be buying up more properties to combat the Rush Limbaughs of the world, and they have a lot of environmental programming. And last but not least, there's a new company coming to town that's going to be launching in April called Verde.com, and they are setting up headquarters here and in Atlanta. There's a CNN connection, and they are billing themselves as the CNN for the environment, and they're going to be offering environmental news coverage for print, radio, and television outlets like CNN, New Oxygen Network, and they're hiring, and they're also very committed to this. And I think those are all good signs that perhaps the time has come. This may be our century.
Question, when your boss has turned down a story idea, how often have you each felt the reason was we don't want to take them on, even though this may not have been stated?
Honestly, rarely. For me, the times when we've had story ideas that I thought were good story ideas and that were turned down, it was mainly a matter of money. It would cost too much, $5, $10, $20, $30,000 to do a story, and my bosses will tell me, no, we won't pay that. So I rarely get that kind of opinion. In fact, quite the contrary. My newsroom is sort of antagonistic to the status quo, and we have a lot of rabble-rousers, if you will, who got into the business of journalism to try to right wrongs and put idealism first. And so, frankly, we've never been scared away from a story because we don't want to deal with the people we've had to confront. It's always, in my opinion, been a matter of resources.
Jane, have you had a problem in this area?
I would say so, but I think, too, it's, you know, how much money they're going to spend. You know, I mean, when I started working there in 86, I went to Alaska after the spill, after the Exxon Valdez wreck, went to Louisiana as part of a series on offshore oil drilling when they were thinking about doing it off our coast in the 80s. And we just don't travel that much anymore. And I think it does have to do with how much resources the owner's willing to spend more than the story being too controversial.
Betsy, you want to comment on this?
I only had that issue come up once, but it was an interesting one. It was about 2 months ago. I was filling in as a midday anchor, which I do to pay for my trash talk habit. And I had just so happened I was reading Trash Talk Live, wrote it probably the hour before during the network news. That's the nature of deadline news sometimes. And it was all about the dark side of coffee harvesting. And I noticed at about 11:23, as I was just finishing my story during a commercial break, that Trash Talk was sponsored by Starbucks for the very first time. And I thought, oh, my goodness, here we go. What do I do? And I went into a minor panic, and in those 2 minutes of soul-searching, I decided, well, of course, I just go on with the show. And no one said anything. So it was a pretty interesting juxtaposition because I was really saying the person in the feature was talking about the environmental problems and that we're now just beginning to hear about. And then Starbucks came on promoting the joys of coffee drinking. And I made that decision in a split second, but I'm glad I made the decision I did. And I don't think it'll get any more difficult than that.
Our thanks to John Fowler of KTVU Channel 2, Jane Kay of the San Francisco Examiner, and Betsy Rosenberg of KCBS for speaking to us tonight. I'm Michael Krasny. We also want to thank you, our audience in San Francisco, as well as those listening to us on radio now. This meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.